Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the midst of our fall pledge drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Help us reach our $55,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Science has been under attack in a big way for the past few years. But while most of us are focusing on right-wing attacks on mainstream science, such as climate chaos and COVID vaccines, there is a longer history of scientists who are persecuted for challenging mainstream paradigms that benefit the captains of industry and their academic and political allies. Today we talk with Dominic Della Sala, who has edited a new book called Speaking Truth to Power, a collection of essays by and about dissident scientists, especially in the field of forest science, who have fought to get their research published and respected despite brutal attacks by the gatekeepers of convention. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on your show again.
Well, it's great to have you on, but this has been a really hard time to be getting through, and so I hope that maybe you can help me get through this week, because we have seen here in Portland an incredible rise in gun violence. We're seeing it around the world, actually, and I understand there was a mass murder in Russia the other day. We're seeing levels of violence that I think are really, I can't recall in my lifetime anything like this. Maybe we have to go back to the 14th century to see something like this. And this is in the face of the COVID pandemic and this incredible specter of climate chaos. So I wonder how we frame a discussion today about the importance of scientists as advocates in the face of just all these horrors that we're living through right now.
Yeah, you know, I think you've pitched it really well. I mean, we're facing unprecedented challenges around the globe, and I think people feel it, and being cooped up because of the pandemic has certainly made people's tempers flare up, and we're not treating each other as respectful human beings would, but we're really kind of personalizing our differences as a nation. And we're really a bipolar nation at this point. And it's not just the U.S., it's happening all around the globe with tensions just flaring up. And I think it's the result of the pandemic, economic strife, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and climate chaos is now being superimposed on that, which is really going to be the challenge of our times.
I was talking with some friends the other night, and we all sort of came to the conclusion that what really probably triggered this wave of violence, in fact, was Donald Trump, that he opened the door to permission to act out the worst of ourselves. I'm wondering if that's something that you also see and how that ties into all the other issues we're having right now.
Yeah, you know, I'm no big supporter of Trump by any means. He's the worst president we've ever had. However, he's just the mouthpiece. He's the bullhorn. There's some 30 to 35% of the country that's always been kind of this fringe element that is threatening our democracy. And Trump was just their king in making that a potential reality. I mean, we got really close to losing democracy in this country on January 6th. We could get really close again. It could tip us in the next election. We don't really know for sure, but certainly that concern is out there that he's the bullhorn, and there's a lot of people that support him, and our voting rights, democracy, voting for people of color is all at risk, and women's rights in the South, all at risk right now, and he's just the bullhorn.
Well, one of the big targets of this far-right movement is science, actually. And that's one of the things that has been a real head scratcher for me, that it seems that science was once revered in this country. I mean, I remember back in 1957 when Russia launched its first Sputnik, and the United States started scrambling to improve, even to start having actual science and math education in the schools so we could catch up with Russia in the space race. And there was a period where scientists were just esteemed, but it seems like that's really different now. And in fact, a lot of scientists, people who are completely reputable, people like Anthony Fauci, are being scorned by a large sector of this population. So how do you account for this?
You know, this really isn't nothing new. I mean, the persecution of scientists has gone back centuries. I mean, in the Dark Ages, it was mostly religious persecution. You know, we had our earliest astronomers, Copernicus, Galileo, which were persecuted for their views about the Earth not being the center of the solar system. And when they discovered that wasn't the case and they announced that, they were persecuted. These are inconvenient truths in many respects. And when you are speaking truth to power, you're going to encounter resistance. We've seen it with the debate years ago over tobacco, whether it causes cancer. Industry lined up their scientists, and fortunately, speaking truth to power at that time led to today's restrictions on tobacco use. And we're in a similar situation now with climate chaos. And to the media's credit, when this was really heating up, pun intended, a few years ago, they were giving credit to both sides. But now, recognizing the overwhelming evidence that climate chaos is caused by human activities around the globe, mainly the use of fossil fuels and deforestation, the media is now just focusing on the issue and not looking for a rebuttal to it, because there's no longer a debate in the scientific community. However, when you mix in politics, that's when it gets personal. That's when the attacks start, and that's when scientists are put in the position of having to defend themselves as the messenger. And we all know that in a crisis, it's not wise to shoot the messenger.
Well, I find it interesting to see the progression for climate scientists who, in the beginning, back when Jim Hansen was announcing that we just had a few decades to turn around the exploding climate crisis, otherwise this Earth would be uninhabitable by the end of the next century. And he was shot down a lot. But now it seems that climate chaos is understood as this is real science and that it's considered mainstream. And I'm curious about how you see the progression of how something that was so much of a maverick field turns into the common knowledge and the common agreement.
Yeah, you know, I think what's going on is, and we've seen this with the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the UN Secretary General, after getting those latest findings by the IPCC, announced that the planet is in a code red emergency. And that report that he was referencing was signed off by hundreds of scientists, just about every government on the planet that is concerned now about what the climate crisis means. I think people are increasingly aware of how it's impacting them personally. I mean, let's look at what happened in the Northwest this summer. Down here where I live in Southern Oregon, I counted 5 major heat domes. It was 117 degrees on one day down here. Up in British Columbia, it was 121 degrees. People don't have air conditioning in BC. There were heat-related mortalities going on, and we're just now in the ramp-up phase. What's going to happen when it really accelerates in the decade or so ahead if we don't change our direction immediately? And I think people are starting to increasingly realize that these towns in the West that are burning down, these super hurricanes, we're now talking about Category 6 hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast. We've seen repeat hurricanes hitting the same location, repeat fires hitting the same location, and burning down towns. And, you know, we haven't even talked about sea level rise and what that means to millions of people that are going to have to find another place to live in the next couple of decades as their coastal communities are inundated. I mean, look at South Florida. It's already experiencing sea level rise, and we're seeing it in many places in the island nations. And so in the next 10 or 20 years, it's going to go from significant to severe, and if we don't do something soon, there are going to be large portions of the planet that switch into intolerable to uninhabitable.
Well, it's interesting to see how the vast majority of scientists around the world now agree that climate chaos is upon us, and it is also human-made. And the people who are now the dissident scientists in that field are these crackpots. And I wonder how we work to call them out, because it's a really different story dealing with somebody who's now saying that climate change is natural or it doesn't exist or whatever. But how do you compare that to someone like you, who's also a dissident scientist, who's been calling out particularly the forest industry for years and years and years about practices that are really unscientific and destructive to the ecosphere?
Well, science is an objective way of looking at a problem and posing it as a question and then gathering the data and the evidence to really investigate what's the causal agent behind the question of interest. I mean, that's really the scientific method. It's been in place since the early 1600s. That hasn't changed. What we do with that science is the real challenge. And when you have experts lined up on both sides of the issue and you've got a, let's say it's a lawmaker right in the middle, they're asking for, well, you know, their side has science, you have science, I need to decide. My stakeholders are bugging me that we need to, you know, log the forest to stop the forest fires. What do I do? And so we get into these dueling science things that clouds the whole issue. And in reality, that gets sorted out in peer review. The science is on our side, unequivocally. Climate change is human caused. And we know when we log the forest, we make it worse. We put more emissions into the atmosphere that gives us larger fires. That evidence is out there. What we do with it is the challenge. And when you have lawmakers that are wedded to political contributions from the timber industry, you know, the science isn't going to do it alone. The same thing on the climate crisis. When you have lawmakers that are receiving political contributions from oil and gas companies, then, you know, chances are they're not going to vote on the correct side of the issue, regardless of the science. So what we need is a global movement. And the thing that really brings me hope is it's being led by young people like Greta Thunberg, working with scientists like Dr. James Hansen, one of the first scientists to testify in the U.S. Senate in the 1980s on climate change. We were really close to solving it back then. It was Ronald Reagan that stepped in and nixed all the action that was being talked about in the Senate at the time to resolve the climate crisis. And so here we are, four decades later, with the crisis mounting. We have all the science we need to solve the problem. What we need is action.
Well, speaking of Ronald Reagan, it reminds me of a number of years ago, I was interviewing a scientist at Battelle Labs out at Hanford. And he was one of the scientists working for the Department of Energy, basically saying that we can expand our nuclear program. We'll find a place for the nuclear waste, whatever. I mean, he was basically saying we can figure out a problem. And so I'm asking him these questions, and he says to me, well, we're scientists. We know the truth. And I'm looking at him, and behind him was a picture of Jesus Christ and Ronald Reagan. And I thought that that spoke volumes about what his idea of the truth was. So how would you talk to somebody like that?
Yeah, you know, the truth is kind of like reality. And how do you define reality? It's based on the individual's perception of the issue, right? And to give you an example, you know, when I go in and I see a burned forest landscape, if I'm standing alongside a forester, they're going to see that same landscape as, wow, look at all that fuel out there, and it's going to burn even hotter in the next fire. I'll look at the same exact piece of ground, and I'll say, that place is now full of wildlife, wildflowers, and you know what? If it burns again, it's really not going to burn hot because most of the combustible materials is already burned in the fire. So we both see our own truths. And the only way to get to the real truth is through objective science, through peer review, through constant back and forth in the scientific literature until a consensus emerges, which is now what we have on climate change. There's no legitimate scientist that's arguing that it isn't happening or it isn't caused by human activities. There was, you know, 10 years ago, but now it's unequivocal. We caused it. And we also can provide the solution. So I think truth needs to be defined objectively through the scientific methodology, and we argue in the scientific literature all the time about it.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala, who's the editor of a new book called Speaking Truth to Power. So let's talk a little bit about this book that you put together. And what is your motivation behind putting out a book called Speaking Truth to Power?
Yeah, you know, it kind of starts with my personal influences in why I became a scientist. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn and the concrete jungle. And it wasn't until my family took me out to the mountains, the Catskill Mountains, when I was a child, that I began to develop a curiosity of nature. And when you develop a curiosity of something as beautiful as a natural environment, you start to appreciate it. And when you start to appreciate and understand it through the process of observation, you know, what's going on in these forest ecosystems? How are the animals responding? How are the plants growing over time? When you ask those questions through science or just casual observations, you start to appreciate something. So that when you see it being abused, then you need to speak out. At least that's what inspired me. And then I started reading some of the works of Carl Sagan, Albert Einstein, Rachel Carson, Jane Goodall, all these luminary scientists that were also advocates for a particular position that they believed in. You could still be an objective scientist and speak out. And through the years of working as a scientist, one thing that I realized is that we had a debate going in the scientific community about whether we should speak out, and that scientists suck as communicators. They're terrible about it. So they need a process for how to speak to the public, how to translate complicated constructs about nature, the climate, biodiversity, forest fires, in a way that the media and the general public can understand, and how they can still maintain their objectivity as scientists by also being citizens of a planet that's in crisis.
Well, I think it's interesting you mentioned that litany of luminaries, and we think of them all as just having made massive contributions to the world. And a lot of people don't understand just how much of a challenge it was. I think Albert Einstein didn't receive a Nobel Prize until, was it like the 1950s? It was for the work he did in 1906 and 1905 with special theory of relativity. So why was it that these people had such a hard time actually breaking through? And why are they accepted as the pillars of science now?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I read Albert Einstein's biography when I was putting together the book, and he had a sense of humor too. And there's a section in his biography, and I'm just paraphrasing here. He said that when he wrote the theory of relativity, he got a response with over 100 scientists on a letter saying that he was wrong. And in his biography, he said, if I was wrong, it would have only taken one scientist. So, you know, tongue-in-cheek humor was part of Einstein's communication, and it's needed in the science world, believe me. We got to find ways like that to communicate. But I think what happens in science is that it's like a punctuation of equilibrium, if you will. So the scientific community tends to build theories on hypothesis testing over time. And really the big advances that occur is when you punctuate that equilibrium, that consensus and viewpoints with a new discovery. And then it becomes exciting. And for example, if we all believed in one way, then science would be boring. But if we were able to build on the accomplishments of others and then found new discoveries by smashing old paradigms that just weren't correct, then the whole field advances. And we've seen that with work of Einstein, with the work of Aldo Leopold on, you know, some of his writings about nature, Rachel Carson, Silent Spring. Those were all paradigm smashers. Carl Sagan, same thing. And they're generally almost uniformly criticized when they smashed the dominant paradigm. And this is how science advances. There's no need to go after a person's reputation because they found a new discovery that goes against the prevailing thinking. We can sort it out in the scientific literature, but it's become personal that when an inconvenient truth is realized and revealed through a new discovery, those scientists face immediate persecution as paradigm smashes. And if they're wrong, then fine. Then that's how science proceeds. But if they're correct, then that's the way we punctuate the equilibrium in a theory that's just flat wrong, but that everybody thought was correct originally.
Well, as I was reading some of the articles in your book, this name popped back into my head, Daniel Donato. And actually, he was involved in the center of a firestorm, so to speak, actually when you and I were first starting to work together back in the middle aughts, 2000 aughts. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the work that he did and how badly he was slammed for it. And I guess he's done okay because I was Googling him and now he's at the University of Wisconsin and he's got his own institute. So he survived that one. But let's talk a little bit about Daniel Donato and what that showed about the difficulty of particularly, he was a graduate student at the time, of being able, of challenging the paradigm, the dominant paradigm back in that day.
Yeah, I know Dr. Donato, and he was a fine scientist then. He's a fine scientist now. And at the time, his inconvenient truth was an objective analysis based on field plots that he and his colleagues had in the Biscuit Fire area. The Forest Service was claiming that salvage logging was needed to lower the fuels and recover the forest from a major fire event back then. So Dan put out his plots and surveyed the conifers that were coming back after the fire and also measured the fuel that was left behind by logging. And what he found was the logging was actually killing the natural reproduction of conifers coming back from that fire, which was more prolific than any Forest Service was planting in those burned areas. They were getting more trees just by natural processes than by planting them. And he also discovered that the fine fuels like logging slash was actually going to prime the fire for the next big fire event that would be a severe burn. That's uncharacteristic. When he put that into published literature in Science magazine, it was attacked by several of the scientists at Oregon State University. A hearing was conducted in Medford, Oregon, led by then Congressman Greg Walden and others. And it was theater. And at that time, he was a master's student. And he handled himself brilliantly in pushing back on the attacks to him and his research design. So, I mean, this is just an example of what scientists face when they discover an inconvenient truth. And the inconvenient truth at that time was salvage logging was a big boom for helicopter logging industries that were pulling big trees out of that fire area that shouldn't have been taking those big trees because they're so ecologically important and they were leaving behind the flammable slash that could burn big time in the next fire event.
I remember actually one of his biggest challengers was Brian Barrett, who at that time was the U.S. representative from that Southwest District of Washington State, right across the river from Portland. And he was really nasty. What's interesting is I think that his background is in psychology. He knows nothing about forest ecology. And I wonder what that said to you about the way that Brian Barrett really went on a personal attack on Dan Donato.
Well, I've been where Dan was, and I still am. I've testified numerous times in Congress, both at the state and also at the federal level. And this is what scientists face all the time. And it comes usually from lawmakers that have an economic interest in the outcome, that have political contributions coming from big corporations. And so when you speak about an inconvenient truth, like logging causes problems for wildlife, for water quality, for salmon. It raises the fuels in the forest because you leave behind the logging slash. That, to them, is an attack on their economic basis for being in Congress for the, you know, for where they stand. And this is why it's not the science that's not objective. It's the policy that is not objective, because there are so many economic forces that are pulling the strings of decision makers that they're going to twist and cherry pick the science because the outcomes are beneficial to them.
Well, do you think that Dan Donato's work was actually groundbreaking, and that the science has shifted since then? Are we still fighting the same battles?
It was groundbreaking at the time, but it wasn't rocket science. And I think Dan would admit that too. It was a basic analysis, and it was, you know, seminal, because at the time it dispelled a lot of the prevailing thinking. But since then, we've had over two decades of science that supports what Dan found, and that has unequivocally stated the negative impacts of post-fire logging on forest ecosystems. It just doesn't allow for the natural recovery processes, the rejuvenation of the forest. It raises the fuel hazards. It pollutes streams with sediment. I mean, this has just been a pylon of studies since Dan's seminal work, you know, over two decades ago.
But we're still having the same arguments now about all the burns that happened last summer along the Umpqua, the Mackenzie, the Santiam, the Clackamas. And there's lawsuits against the Willamette National Forest right now. We're going to be doing a show about that soon. And actually, I got a very exhilarating email from BARC, which is a forest advocacy group that's in the Mount Hood National Forest, fighting to protect that forest. And they've been doing it for a long time. And they sent out an email saying that the Forest Service has actually listened to them and has stopped the logging along the Clackamas River until they do more studies. So do you think, it seems like we're in the middle of a kind of a bifurcated setup right now, where there's a lot of forces that still would be the same people that went after Dan Donato, but it seems like maybe there's some people who are listening to what he said and what subsequent scientists have said.
Yeah, you know, I think there are certainly important victories like that, and to BARC's credit for setting the tone on that. And, you know, it's not a question of the science, it's what you do with the science. And in my experience, there's a lot of cherry picking going on, that a lot of the science that disagrees with the perspective of decision makers doesn't get the time of day. Let me give you another example. I served on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recovery team for the Northern Spotted Owl. And this is a chapter in my book. I think it's chapter 5. And I, at the time, it was the George W. Bush administration. And they were playing a shell game about the recovery of the spotted owl. They were trying to move the discussion off of habitat protection, protecting old forest that the owl needs, to the main threat being fire and barred owls. I had argued that you can't do that, because in order for the spotted owl to survive, it needs habitat. And yet it became politicized. And yet they used a incorrect model to determine that owls are being impacted by these big fires. Even though the field work that was going on then and is still happening today has showed that the spotted owl does okay in these big fires, as long as it can move around in search of these little pockets of unburned areas to nest in. Those severe burned areas are really good foraging habitat for spotted owls. Yet the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, continues to treat burned areas as no longer spotted owl habitat, and therefore okays logging, like post-fire logging in them, even though the birds are still using those sites. And it's because they're basing their assumptions on a scientifically flawed model that's not paying attention to the accumulation of new research over time. They have cherry-picked the science. They're wedded to a particular philosophy that the only way to save the owl now is to log the forest and to deal with the barred owl problem. And they're completely ignoring the evidence that's being collected now since those models were developed when I was on the recovery team in 2006.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic Della Sala, who's editor of a new book called Speaking Truth to Power. And I want to remind you that we are also in the midst of our fall pledge drive here on KBOO Community Radio. You can become a member by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, Dominic, I want to get back to what you mentioned a little while ago about agenda-driven science. You talk about, a lot of the people who write in your book talk about that. What is agenda-driven science, or what does that term mean?
Yeah, this has become the new way to bracket and therefore disparage scientists when they are perceived as having a minority opinion on an issue, or that they're fake scientists, or what they've discovered is somehow not real or legitimate or is biased based on values. And it's being used as the death knell for destroying a scientist's reputation. It's been used over time to brand scientists that originally were concerned about climate change and did some of the early studies on how the planet was changing with respect to the loss of biodiversity and to widespread fossil fuel use. And the way this argument goes is that scientists are supposed to be somehow valueless, objective citizens. We're supposed to have no values when it comes to observing the real world. That is completely unrealistic. There's no such thing as a valueless person. And in the book, we point this out. You know, we're individuals, we're citizens. We're not some fictitious character like Data on Star Trek or Spock. You know, that we have no values, no emotions. It's unrealistic to think that. And yet, when we speak out, we're branded as being agenda-driven. And I just want to, you know, for the record, I state this in the book. Okay, so you're going to criticize me for being agenda-driven. Let's at least get the agenda right. So here's what I stand for. I stand for a livable planet. I stand for a safe atmosphere. I stand for a future prosperous world that's populated by abundant wildlife populations, wild areas, places we could go and experience nature. Our kids, our grandkids can have those, at least those same values as we do. And you know what? I'm still an objective scientist. I could still apply the scientific method with my values, and I could still then take that information and use it to present to decision makers, hoping that they'll use it in their ability to solve these crises. So if you're going to call me agenda-driven, at least get the agenda right. And I've been called a fake scientist, a minority scientist for my views on the climate and my views on biodiversity. So be it. The science isn't wrong. You might not like my value system, but if you disagree with me, then perhaps, you know, your value system is you don't want a safe climate and you don't want a safe planet and you don't want, you know, biodiversity. So we can have that argument.
Well, it seems that the actual agenda-driven scientists, the ones who are working for industry, and you look at who funds research and who funds these studies that are counter to the ones that you and your cohort are working on. How do you bring that to the public?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up because I'm dealing with it right now in a set of point and counterpoint articles in a scientific journal where, again, I was accused of being agenda-driven by scientists that are getting their money from the U.S. Forest Service in contracts to do fuels reduction involving logging. So how is that not agenda-driven? And the same thing goes for colleagues that have been criticized along with me as agenda-driven. They did some of the work on spotted owls showing that the owls are using areas that were burned. And then a paper came out disparaging their findings claiming that they were agenda-driven by scientists that had a contract with the U.S. Forest Service that prohibited them from making any statements to the contrary about fuels management. So who's agenda-driven in that scenario?
So I think one of the big questions that comes up is, how do you help scientists to communicate to the general public? A number of years ago, I was taking a fellowship at the University of Colorado on environmental journalism, and we were addressed by a number of climate scientists who were just chastising the media for presenting a very skewed view of the science of climate science. Basically, at that time, it was done as he said, she said, is what the scientists were saying. And they were excoriating us to really get the story straight. And so one of the journalists in the room shouted out, well, you need to figure out how to communicate with us. And I think that was a big problem back in 2004, and it still is a problem to some degree. Though people like Carl Sagan and some of the other people that you've mentioned as mentors are really great at communicating. But it seems like a lot of scientists still don't really know how to get out of their ivory tower.
Yeah, let me answer that by first stating this. We have a number of examples in the book about how scientists can communicate with the media and with just normal people, right? And one analogy that I have in the book is, let's say that you go to the doctor because you're not feeling well, and they do a series of tests, blood tests on you. And unfortunately, the results come back that, oh my God, you've got some really bad disease and you're going to get worse. And so every doctor takes the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, to help the patient always. And so why would you expect the doctor to take those findings, walk that patient down the hall to someone else that's trained as an advocate? You wouldn't expect that, right? You'd say, this is crazy. You're my doctor. You should be my advocate. Tell me what I need to do. Why do we expect anything different from a climate change scientist, from a biodiversity scientist, reading the planetary signals, saying, oh man, we've got a major problem unfolding here. Here's why. But instead of saying what we should be doing, they take it down to the hall to a social scientist and say, here, you deal with it and you figure out what to do next. So, I mean, that would be irresponsible. So we're calling for a planetary Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, to treat the planet as a living being and not something that we continue to abuse.
Well, one of the things I think we can thank the Trump administration for is I think it really turned a number of scientists into advocates more self-consciously. I'm thinking about the Science March, the first Science March in 2017. Do you see that there's a shift now and that more scientists are appreciating that they have a very important role as advocate?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually signed on to a letter that Bill Ripple at Oregon State University drafted back in the early 90s at the first Earth Summit in Rio. There were about 1,000 of us that were on that letter that said to the world's governments at the time that we had an emerging crisis. This is 1992. So, you know, fast forward 3 decades later, and Bill sent out a similar letter that has now, I think, over 23,000 scientists on it. So a lot more people speaking out. Clearly, our communications in terms of reaching other scientists are much greater now than they were back in 1992. But it brings hope to me to know that there are that many scientists, and Bill has a website, the Alliance for World Scientists, that are involved in these global issues. So we're seeing more and more of these scientists speaking out, and because our future may very well depend on it.
One of the things that I still think is kind of lacking is more mainstream media that focuses on science. And I keep thinking, like, the principal science show that most people listen to is Science Friday on NPR with Ira Flatow, which I think has some advantages and some drawbacks. And there's, I guess, probably quite a few podcasts now that deal with science. But it seems that with all the subjects that people listen to on the radio, watch on television, science still doesn't have a very big role. Even it's a little bit more with least health sciences because of the pandemic. But I wonder how you see reaching out more through the mainstream media and having more science shows that really deal with scientific issues in a very fair and open and challenging way.
Yeah, and I think there are people doing this. David Attenborough is wonderful about nature. Neil deGrasse Tyson is just amazing. He's another Carl Sagan advocate like I am. And that's encouraging to see that. And we just have to do more of it. And we've got to work with communicators. We've got to work with groups that are doing advocacy. And in the book, we talk about, you know, advocacy for scientists does not have to be treated as if it's a four-letter word. There are rules of engagement in science, and there are rules of engagement for scientists that want to be advocates. You could still do this and be objective about it, but you got to get better about your communication skills. And in the book, we talk about the scientific method follows this kind of talking pyramid, if you will, in terms of how we organize our thoughts. We see a problem, we state it as a hypothesis, we collect observations, we run statistical analysis, we look at our results, we double check them, we triple check them, we publish, we go through peer review, and we reach our findings. That doesn't work in the news world. You have to be prepared with your elevator speech. You've got 15 seconds for a soundbite. You might be on an elevator stop with a U.S. senator. You can't go through that kind of communications pyramid. You got to turn it upside down. You got to get to the question of what's in it for me? Why is this important? And in the back pocket, you've got all that other great stuff that scientists really excel at, the scientific method. It's right there with you. It's your buddy, but you don't lead with that buddy. You have it in case you run into a savvy legal assistant in that senator's office that wants to know the details of the science. We're not taught that way to communicate. We're taught the scientific methodology. And it sucks when you're communicating to normal people and to the public and decision makers. And that's my challenge to scientists. You're really great at talking and preaching to the choir. And if you really care about the planet, you've got to get better about communicating to people that don't understand the scientific process.
I wonder if there's a way, though, to kind of popularize the scientific method, because it is really a very valuable tool in understanding reality and understanding all the challenges facing us.
It's the best we have for looking at the world through an objective lens, as objective as we can be. And again, we all have values, and those values are going to be there. And it's best to state those values up front instead of saying you're valueless. But I don't think it's the scientific methodology that needs to be popularized necessarily. I think it's the way we communicate about it. And the scientific methodology, you know, it's been in play now for over four centuries. And it really works for looking at the world objectively. Sometimes, you know, it needs to be, you know, directed into a different area through new discoveries. But this is the best we have for looking at problems and solving them objectively. It's just we've got to get better at communicating about it, and we've got to educate decision makers. It all starts in school. And, you know, I lecture at universities quite often, and the first thing out of my mouth, and I'm not being narcissistic, but I'll say, this is the most important lecture you'll ever hear, because someday I might be debating you as a county commissioner or a U.S. senator because you don't understand the science. So please pay attention to science, because this is so important to your future as a student and as a future leader in helping to solve these planetary problems.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala, who's editor of a new book called Speaking Truth to Power. Well, I want to go back to where we started in the beginning, where we're talking about how science itself is under attack. And I kind of want to tie in the ways in which dissident scientists like yourself are under attack from the mainstream science gatekeepers, but tie that back to the way that the public is kind of going on the attack against all science.
Yeah, and I think it's a certain element of the public. So, you know, there's a lot of educated people out there too, thankfully. And they're showing up at these rallies, which is wonderful to see. You know, we're seeing thousands of people marching for science, you know, arm in arm with the Black People Matter movement, the movement for women. And we're seeing more of this working together with Greta Thunberg. So there's a lot of really educated people out there that care about the planet, that care about social justice issues, that are working together with scientists. It's just this 30 to 35% element that's always been part of our culture that's going to be denying science as some sort of elitist way to just disrupt society. And it's, you know, as far from the truth as possible. So I don't know how you get around that other than you keep the speaking truth to power, realizing that science alone is not going to solve our problems. It will help guide us to those solutions. But the only way to solve our problems is we've got to recognize we've got a problem. We've got to work towards the solution together. And often that means grassroots movements. It means young people speaking out to change things. It means, you know, working in coalition and trying to resolve these issues with always having science as the backdrop in how we approach these problems. But it really is going to take a lot more heavy lifting than just the science alone can provide.
I wonder how we talk to people who are just anti-science. I mean, they will bring up their own experts and say, this is what the scientists we believe in say. And they don't even bother to see that the people that they're bringing up have absolutely no credentials or any background to be having these opinions. How do we reach those people?
Yeah, well, we've got a real problem with that. And, you know, let's just talk about the pandemic for a minute. And there's still this element out there that won't get vaccinated, that won't wear masks. And it's not just Trump supporters. There's a lot of well-meaning, well-intentioned people that care about their bodies, that care about nature, that care about, you know, issues that we probably would agree with 90% of the times, but they just will refuse to listen to the science, and they're getting a lot of their information from Facebook and from social media. It's not even misinformation, it's disinformation. And that's what really concerns me, because I think the challenge is if we can't at least prepare ourselves more effectively for a global pandemic like this, how the heck are we going to solve for climate change? And I'm telling you, in the next couple of decades, the climate chaos is not only going to affect everyone on the planet, which it already is doing, but it's going to be much, much greater in terms of the disruptions to society, to our health, to all our institutions than even the global pandemic is today. And that really worries me, because the amount of disinformation that's being spread on social media, not only about the pandemic, but by climate change, is preventing science from shining the light on the solution.
Well, one interesting note I read today, that 92% of Democrats across the country have at least one COVID shot, and most of them have two, but only 56% of Republicans. So right there, I mean, even though you talk about the people who aren't Trump supporters who are also not getting vaccinated, it seems like the vast majority of people who are liberals, so to speak, are getting vaccinated. It's leaving this other part of the country in really dire shape. And I saw a slogan today, red COVID, meaning COVID is now taking over the red states. It makes me wonder what it will take to change people's minds, what kind of catastrophe it will take, or can we not have to have it be a catastrophe for some people to finally kind of get that there's something else out there they have to look at?
Yeah, you know, you point out this issue, you know, the science debate, the pandemic, climate change has become a red-blue issue. But in reality, you know, those problems know no political boundaries. They affect all of us. And if we don't deal with this pandemic to the point of which, you know, most of our citizens are vaccinated and are wearing masks, there will be new mutations. And those mutations will largely come from the unvaccinated. If we don't deal with the planetary biodiversity and climate crisis, there will be unprecedented changes that will affect everyone on this planet. It can't be looked at as a red-blue issue, a Democrat, Republican, Trumper, non-Trumper. It's everyone involved, and we all need to be working together towards the solution. And we've got to get beyond the political differences, the disinformation campaigns, and get into some real solutions. And again, I keep coming back to, it's going to take a grassroots movement working with sound science to get to the solution. And hopefully, when enough people wake up, there's still enough time to resolve this. But, you know, the sand in the hourglass is running pretty low right now.
So what's your next step, Dominic? What are you going to do now that your book is published?
I work on my next book. I don't know.
How do you see this book being used?
Yeah. The next step is to get it out there. And it's to get in front of decision makers. It's to get in front of the folks that are still movable. I mean, in any kind of political campaign, a campaign strategist know this. You don't work at the extremes, whether, you know, you want to make sure you shore up your base, but you're not going to get people that are so far extreme out there. It's just not worth the effort. You've got to work in the middle. So somewhere we've got to find where that middle is, where that middle ground is that, you know, people are on the fence about it. They're not quite sure which direction to go in. That's how you win campaigns. You bring those people along so you build a majority, you build a consensus, and you get that information out there. We know how to solve climate change. This isn't rocket science. We know we're the cause. The Earth has a fever. And here's how we solve the problem. We switch from fossil fuel polluting emissions that's causing this greenhouse dilemma, and we treat our forest as a sink for absorbing atmospheric carbon. We go to renewable clean energies and we do it right away. And the technology is out there to start making those changes. It's a matter of political will and the right investments. This is solvable, but we only have about a decade to do it.
It seems that the book is actually addressed a lot to scientists, and I'm wondering what the intention is there.
It's to, you know, build on that movement. And, you know, there needs to be more of us out there willing to speak up. Take the plunge. It's okay to do so. You could do it following the rules of engagement we laid out in the book, still being true to the science, and we need you. I mean, the planet has never been in a crisis like this before. This is why I think it comes back to our early discussion, why, people are getting more antsy, more aggressive, they're feeling cooped up, they're feeling helpless. Turn that into action, whether you're a scientist or an advocate. We need to be working our energy towards the solution rather than just being, you know, grieving about it or feeling helpless. We still have time. That's the good news. And if we work together as a unified voice across all interests, this is solvable. And scientists need to be part of the effort leading the way to the solution. That's why I did the book.
So we just had a climate strike last Friday, and it was a massive movement all around the world. I wonder if that gives you some hope that you're connecting to a very powerful force of young people.
Absolutely. I think that's what I derive my hope from. I mean, my generation is too screwed up at this point. And I feel the need to do whatever I can to pass the baton to the next generation so that they can experience at least the values of nature and a safe climate that I experienced growing up, at least, if not better. And it gives me hope that young people are leading this charge. I have 3 grandkids and 2 daughters, and I'm doing this now. It's personal for me. That's my agenda. I care about the next generation, including my own. And if we don't do something here really soon, the crisis will unfold and they will bear the biggest part of the impact.
Well, Dominic, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus today.
Yeah, you bet. And the full book's title is conservation science and advocacy for a planet in peril, speaking truth to power.
We've been talking with Dominic Della Sala, editor of a new book called Speaking Truth to Power. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us now during our fall pledge drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week we'll talk with Eric Strutzig, author of Swaplands. We'll go out with some music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
Skies go. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. Mercy. All things and what they used to be lost. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Lost mother. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?